For our blind and print impaired audience, the North Carolina Reading Service now brings you The Indie Week, and it's read by John Feddersen today. Our issue, dated June the 16th of 2023. And as the format is changing, the online edition, IndieWeek.com, is our chief source. We're still getting some articles from the bi-weekly, or every other week, print edition of The Independent. But we'll be hearing more and more from the online version as we progress. And let's fade that music out and get on with our issue, please. First up, a quick follow-up to an article originally published at NC Newsline by Lisa Sorg. James Lyons, Durham's solid waste director, has been fired. He started as the waste director just 3 weeks ago, effective immediately after an NC Newsline investigation into his work history. In an email sent at about 7 p.m. on Tuesday, city manager Wanda Page announced the termination. As the Newsline reported earlier Tuesday, the city paid a national search firm, Poly Hire, $25,000 to recruit qualified candidates for the solid waste director position. Page said in the press release that Poly Hire, quote, has confirmed that their process, which included screening of candidates for minimum requirements, did not happen as contracted. In his resume, on which the city based its hiring announcement just in April the 27th, Lyons claimed to have worked for the city of High Point as its solid waste collection superintendent since 2015. However, High Point told NC Newsline that Lyons was employed in that position only from January of 2022 to April 2023, roughly 15 months. And Lyons' own LinkedIn page, since deactivated, listed his job with High Point as lasting from 2020 to 2023, which was also untrue. As a sidelight, Lyons ran for the mayorship of Durham in 2015 and lost in the November election to the incumbent Bill Bell. All right, let's continue with solid waste. In effect, from Durham, this from NC Health News, another partner publication for The Independent, Will Atwater writes, Biden administration aligns with Durham advocates' mission to fight plastic pollution. Distance runners, it begins, must develop two critical traits, mental toughness and the ability to focus on the big picture when obstacles such as fatigue set in. These are characteristics that runner and problem solver Crystal Dreisbach has found valuable in her career tackling environmental issues. Dreisbach is involved in a decade-long marathon to establish in Durham something called a circular economy, which would divert plastic and other waste from landfills and local waterways. She draws parallels between distance running and her environmental work, and she said, if I hit a wall at mile 18 or whatever, I know from experience that I'm going to feel like I'm done. But if I just push through that wall, when I get to the other side, I'll feel better. So it's like the knowledge that if you overcome a challenge, it is better on the other side. Just keep going. The Environmental Protection Agency defines a circular economy as one that keeps materials, products, and services in circulation for as long as possible to slow climate change. If fewer single-use materials, such as plastics, are produced, it lowers CO2 emission from fossil fuels, which are used to make plastics, and it reduces emissions from plastic waste decomposition. At this stage in the race, Dreisbach is garnering support for an ordinance that would reduce plastic weight in Durham by imposing a 10-cent fee per bag paid by retail customers needing bags for purchases. If established, Dreisbach believes the regulation will reduce the plastic waste polluting the environment, including on land, waterways, and in the bodies of marine animals and people. And she's getting a boost from the federal government. On April 21st, the Biden administration published a draft plan for reducing plastic waste at the source, cleaning up the recycling process, and removing litter from the environment. The administration's action signals the federal government is ready to lead in addressing this environmental challenge. Finding the money. Despite the daunting task she's taken on, Dreisbach is willing to share her vision with anyone who will listen. She recently traveled to Washington, D.C., where she spoke to an engaged audience for an Earth Day event titled From Single Use to Reuse, the Growing Reuse Movement. The World Wildlife Fund and Upstream, an organization that works with businesses and institutions to eliminate waste, organized that event. It was attended by more than 100 people, including representatives from federal agencies. Nina Shaw, EPA Acting Director, Resource Conservation and Sustainability Division, said, "This is the first time in my career that we put out our recycling strategy the same day we got funding in the bipartisan infrastructure law. The president signed it, and we have some support from industry and nonprofits and others that are all trying to work towards the same end." Priscilla Johnson, interim CEO at Upstream, says there's an opportunity to reduce plastic waste and boost local economies by creating jobs and adopting a circular economy, which the federal government can support. Quote, "I think funding is the biggest barrier, so the federal government's role in catalyzing private industries like banks to direct their funding to these types of efforts that solve systemic problems is needed. When you look at how plastics and plastics are manufactured, they have a deleterious upstream effect on the most vulnerable communities, and that happens throughout the entire world. Curbing waste is also on the minds of North Carolina lawmakers. In February, NC Health News reported on the North Carolina Managing Waste Act of 2023. The bill, introduced by Representative Harry Warren, Republican of Salisbury, seeks to reduce the amount of non-recyclable waste generated by state agencies. Oceana, an organization that states its mission is to protect the world's oceans, says it is critical for humanity to address the global plastic pollution problems. A statement on the organization website says plastic is everywhere. It's choking our oceans, melting out of the Arctic sea ice, sitting at the deepest point of the seafloor, and raining onto our national parks. It's in the air we breathe, the water we drink, and the food we eat. It's greatly contributing to the climate crisis and disproportionately polluting communities of color and low income. Oceana reports that roughly 33 billion pounds of plastic is deposited into the ocean annually. More than 14.5 million tons of plastic debris were dumped in landfills in 2018, according to the EPA. And a 2021 UN Environment Program report states that the annual global cost associated with plastic pollution was $19 billion in 2018. A 2019 study commissioned by the World Wildlife Fund found that humans digest roughly 5 grams of microplastics weekly. That's enough to form a credit card. While there is no consensus on whether there is a link between microplastic ingestion and human disease, research is underway. One study found that people with inflammatory bowel disease, IBD, had a higher quantity of microplastic particles in their feces than healthy people. Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis are two forms of IBD. Plastic waste that is not recycled often ends up in landfills and releases greenhouse gases as it breaks down into smaller particles. Those gases trap heat in the atmosphere and contribute to global warming. And due to the buildup of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, it's highly likely, quote, at least one of the next 5 years, and the five-year period as a whole, will be the warmest on record. That's a recently released report by the World Meteorological Organization. WMO Secretary General Professor Petteri Talas says this report does not mean we will permanently exceed the 1.5 centigrade temperature level specified in the Paris Agreement, which refers to long-term warming over many years. However, WMO is sounding the alarm that we will breach that 1.5 level on a temporary basis with increasing frequency. Dreisbach says her training as a public health professional and her experience in the Peace Corps and working on international campaigns for international public health contractor FHI 360 gave her the skills that she now uses to take on Durham's waste problem. On her journey toward a circular economy, Dreisbach has endured pushback from critics and delays, including the changeover of mayors and council members along the way, reminding her to view this effort as a marathon, not a sprint. She says, 10 years ago, everyone was laughing at me, but now they're putting me in front of the White House, you know, so clearly I've been following the North Star. Dreisbach's mission led her in 2013 to form Don't Waste Durham, a nonprofit organization that creates solutions that prevent trash, according to its website. During the past decades, initiatives developed by Don't Waste Durham to eliminate waste include boomerang bags made by volunteers out of recycled T-shirts. The bags are free at checkout counters and participating retail shops. Customers who need a bag can borrow one to carry purchases home and return it later, or keep it to use for future purchases. Another initiative established by Don't Waste Durham is Green to Go. That's a fee-for-service program available in selected restaurants and retail outlets that offers customers an option of replacing single-use food containers with reusable ones to transport food home. Once the customer finishes using the container, it's collected, brought to a washing center, sterilized, and returned to the restaurant. Don't Waste Durham is also working with the Durham Public Schools and other city and county agencies on environmental efforts such as improving education around recycling and replacing disposable food containers with reusable stainless foodware, among other initiatives. Dreisbach's work is not going unnoticed. In 2021, she was recognized as the Activist of the Year during the National Reuse Awards, held virtually and sponsored by Upstream and Closed Loop Partners, a circular economy-focused investment firm and innovation center, according to a release, quote, by Matt Prindeville, former CEO at Upstream. Never has recognition of heroes in the reuse movement been more crucial as we experience the multiple effects of climate change and plastic pollution in the air, on land, and in our oceans. The recipients of the reusees are true trailblazers and game-changing innovators of the growing reuse economy. Dreisbach's work is also receiving support from local colleagues. Tobin Freed, Durham County Sustainability Officer, says she doesn't see boundaries. She sees hurdles that need to be overcome. And she goes after hurdles tenaciously. If that doesn't work, she pivots to find another way around it. In 2019, Don't Waste Durham became a client of the Duke Environmental Law and Policy Clinic, where the organization worked with law students and staff to draft policy that supports a reuse economy, such as that proposed plastic bag ordinance. Nancy Lauer, staff scientist and lecturing fellow at the law clinic, says, "I wish there were 100 crystals doing what crystals doing in Durham. Her vision is where we need to be going." And Michelle Nowlin, co-director of Duke Environmental Law and Policy, agrees with Lauer's take on Dreisbach. Crystal has tremendous passion and vision for more environmentally sustainable ways of structuring our science, society, and our economy. Well, Dreisbach says the next leg in Don't Waste Durham's journey toward establishing that circular economy is to get the city council to vote on a proposed 10-cent per bag ordinance. However, there is a significant barrier to overcome before a vote happens. City officials have said that they're only willing to vote on that ordinance if the upcoming budget includes line items for an educational outreach coordinator and a code enforcement officer, according to Dreisbach. Allegedly, the city manager is only willing to have those two positions in a proposed budget with a policy in place. Dreisbach said, "So we're like this chicken and egg situation. The city manager won't recommend the two positions unless the policy has passed." Don't Waste Durham and its supporters are working diligently to address council members' concerns before June 20th, when the vote for the upcoming budget is expected. Shaw acknowledges that establishing a coalition of stakeholders to eliminate single-use plastic waste can be a challenging but worthwhile endeavor, and says, "We don't all agree on everything, but at the same time, the momentum is there. There is a huge desire on the part of the young people, certainly of today, pushing us in that direction because they're not satisfied with the status quo. And they shouldn't be." Now continuing with further articles, this one by Lisa Sorg at NC Newsline. Duke University, Durham Parks and Rec did not inform the public about lead in Durham parks. I will have to severely curtail the entirety of this article because it's many, many pages long, and I'll give you all the details that I can. Soil at three Durham parks, Walltown, East End, and East Durham, and presumably a fourth, Lyon, L-Y-O-N Park, certain levels of lead as much as six times the EPA hazard threshold for play areas, found a study by Duke University. But the university and the Durham Parks and Rec Department sat on those findings for months, sharing them in late May, only after a Walltown resident stumbled upon the research paper online. The four parks share some commonalities. From the early 1900s to 1940, they were home to city-owned incinerators, which burned lead-containing material. They are in historically black neighborhoods and in former redlined areas where environmental racism and health disparities persist. The study explains, quote, "The health risks associated with lead exposure pose a serious environmental justice problem since marginalized and socioeconomically disadvantaged communities tend to have higher lead exposures than the rest of the population. This trend is also evident in soil lead exposure, since many black and other minority communities have been systemically driven to live and work in and around structures that serve as lead sources, such as older houses, gas stations, factories, waste incinerators, and landfills. Lead is a neurotoxin. Chronic exposure can cause permanent neurological and brain damage in children who are especially vulnerable because they spend time outdoors and often put their hands in their mouths. Adults with high blood levels of can suffer from brain, kidney, heart, and reproductive disorders. The letter from the Walltown Community Association to the city and university says, among other things, the delay in communicating these health risks posed by lead in this soil is a failure on the part of Duke and the city of Durham. Had residents not discovered the study on our own and taken the initiative to learn more, it is unclear when exactly the public would have been informed. In late May, a Walltown resident contacted those researchers who presented their findings to the community association on May the 22nd. Durham Parks and Rec knew the research was happening. The study itself notes the department granted access to the parks for the sampling. Parks and Rec reportedly also was aware, quote, "There were findings to share," read a letter from Walltown community to the city manager, "but have not communicated anything to residents in the three affected communities or the broader Durham public." City manager Wanda Page said the city received the information on June the 1st. She shared an update with Walltown on June the 7th. CBS 17 first reported on Duke and the city's delay in disclosing. Deputy City Manager Keith Chadwell and Chief of Staff Carmisha Wallace are planning to attend tonight's virtual meeting, according to a city spokesperson. Then there's some background about who conducted the research and the samplings. Enikoe Bihari, a master's student at Duke University's School for the Environment, sampled soil at these parks for lead. Did not sample the former Lion Park because of time constraints. She found, though, that many shallow soils, no more than an inch deep, exceeded the EPA's hazard thresholds for gardening, residential play areas, and residential non-play areas, which are 100 parts per million, 400 parts per million, and 1,200 ppm, respectively. In all three parks, the incinerators had been located in what are now highly trafficked areas, such as grass fields, sports facilities, playgrounds, and picnic areas. And then the article now lists for these four parks and their addresses. And then there are digests of the lead levels found, which, and some of these I'm going to be excerpting. The first, East Durham Park, which is at 2500 East Main Street. It has a hot spot of lead. The EPA has set a hazard threshold of 400 parts per million for residential play areas, 1,200 in residential non-play areas. Gardens should not be planted in soil with more than 100 ppm. And I will also point out that online, and you can find, if you visit these articles at IndieWeek.com, you can see maps included, which were included in this research paper. One hotspot with extremely high lead levels, 694 parts per million to 2,300 ppm, in an area southeast portion of East Durham Park. These far exceed those thresholds. The study reads, "This is of particular concern because this field is adjacent to an apartment building and residents appear to use this area to play, garden, and park their cars. Underserved communities already face multiple risks from lead exposure in house paint. Because homes tend to be older in these neighborhoods, they often contain lead paint, which wasn't banned for residential use until 1978. That's true in East Durham and in Walltown. State data shows that people living in the census block groups near East Durham also experience rates of asthma hospitalizations 3 to 4 times the state average. These also, the parks, the neighborhoods adjacent to East Durham rank in the 80th to 95th percentile in the United States in terms of potential lead exposure. The next park, Walltown, 1700 Guest Road. The highest levels of lead there are in the center, north of the basketball courts, and the southwest part of the park, across a paved area from Walltown Recreational Center. The EPA set a hazard threshold of 400 parts per million for residential, 1,200 for non-play areas. Gardens should not be planted in soil with more than 100 parts per million. In Walltown, concentrations range from 13 ppm, roughly background level, to 1,300 in the center of the park, near the basketball goals and the horseshoe pits. Again, these neighborhoods are in the 80th to 90th percentile for potential lead paint exposure. And there are other environmental hazards nearby. The park is across the street from Northgate Mall, where, historically, there were oil and fuel spills from car maintenance shops. Rates of asthma hospitalizations in that neighborhood, which includes a section of Interstate 85, exceed the state average. Then, East End Park on 1200 North Alston Avenue. The city's sign shop, which is in disrepair, is thought to be a main source of lead. There are apartments nearby on Lowry Avenue. Again, the map is included on the paper. At East End, levels range from 8 to 1,300 ppm. Lead levels were very high on the south side of the park. That's where the old City Paint and Sign Shop operated. Dilapidated buildings remain behind a chain-link fence on the property. However, because the ground is bare, the study says, contaminated surface soil particles can be easily eroded by wind and water into the neighboring communities. The neighboring environment. East End neighborhoods rank in the 90th percentile and above for lead paint exposure. The census block groups near East Durham Park have rates of asthma, hospitalizations, and child mortality higher than North Carolina average, says state data. That park is just two blocks east of the old Durham gas plant, where deed records show the property is contaminated with hazardous substances. At least one fuel spill occurred at that sign shop, and another two at the Honeywell facility. Then the article moves to Lion Park. Until roughly the city of Durham operated an incinerator there at 1228 Carroll Street, just north of Lakewood Avenue. However, it's likely the soil is contaminated with lead, based on results from the other three park, as well as separate and unrelated testing by U.S. Army contractors. Then there's some story about why the Army planned to sell its property pending environmental testing. The information receivable from this Army study has not been yet released or codified. But a brief report issued by the Army last September suggested contaminants could be present in both soil and groundwater at Lion Park, notably fly ash. That's a byproduct of burning coal, is reportedly buried under the existing military equipment parking area. Before 1950, it would have been common for incinerators to burn coal. Fly ash is considered to be a toxic waste because it can contain lead, arsenic, mercury, chromium-6, even uranium and thorium, both radioactive. Since it is contained under pavement, it's unlikely to be released to the environment. However, if the property were to be excavated, if the pavement was to crack or cave, or if there are other hot spots of ash that could be exposed, that could present an environmental or public health threat. The Army reports the area of the incinerator requires additional information. State records don't document all these old legacy sites, like coal ash dumps from the 1950s, where such activity was virtually unregulated. At Lion Park, the Army is now further investigating possible contamination from the operation of the incinerator, including soil and groundwater sampling. Monitoring wells have been installed on the property, including at that incinerator site. After the investigation is complete, the Army will conduct a second study to determine a cleanup plan, which would have to be approved by the NC Department of Environmental Quality. Finally, in this article, as for the three other parks, the Walltown Association is demanding the city and Duke act quickly to protect the public from exposure to lead and any other contaminants by acting in the following ways. Prevent people from coming into contact in highly contaminated area of the parks till they can be safely cleaned up and retested. Hold community meetings to inform residents of these findings and the risks. Conduct additional testing, plus Lion Park, Northgate, and in Northeast Durham near the central incinerator. Tests should also be done in the park neighborhoods. Expand the county's lead blood testing program to residents there. Direct Durham Parks and Rec to engage with the Duke researchers, the Durham County Health Department, and other relevant government agencies to present an action plan to the mayor in the next 90 days. Document and share what remediation and monitoring efforts have been conducted to date at each site in the next 90 days and make this information publicly available. Finally, publicly apologize to the affected communities. In response, City Manager Wanda Page wrote a letter to Walltown Community Association saying the city is contracting with a state-certified consultant to conduct an environmental assessment of all four parks mentioned. City staff and Durham County Health will also host info sessions with the neighborhoods near the parks, Page wrote, and finished, "Once the city's environmental assessment is completed, I will publicly share our planned next steps on how we will address any findings." Over to Wake County and Raleigh for a couple of articles. Hannah Kaufman's first one. Wake Habitat and Raleigh's LGBTQ Center are partnering to build homes for LGBTQ families. On June 9th, Lindsay Holliday stood in an unfinished kitchen and cried. It wasn't just any kitchen. It was hers. She was one of many volunteers building the house for herself and her partner, making it the first time the LGBTQ couple would own their own home. Friday's Pride Build event, organized by Habitat for Humanity of Wake County and the LGBT Center of Raleigh, brought together more than 70 volunteers to build five houses in Raleigh's Old Pool Place neighborhood, says Aviva Imbri, Habitat Wake's interim director of communications. Quote, "It was a celebration of pride and inclusivity, and the fact we have resources and we want to make sure that everyone is welcome and has a safe, decent home. With no statewide laws preventing housing discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, and in the midst of an affordable housing crisis, homelessness disproportionately affects people in North Carolina's LGBTQ community. According to research from the Trevor Project, 28% of LGBTQ youth will experience homelessness at some point in their lives. The Pride Build, among other volunteer-based Habitat Wake events, gives community members the opportunity to fight the affordable housing crisis through hands-on, team-based work. Friday's work was not easy. After a morning training from the construction team, the volunteers were split up between five houses and put to work, caulking, adding drywall, siding and soffits, measuring, cutting materials and lifting from 8:15 a.m. until late into the afternoon. Upon completion, Old Pool Place will be an entirely Habitat-built community. The neighborhood is a mixture of single-family homes and townhomes, and the organization's next goal is to connect the community with transit stops so residents will have access to public transport like Go Raleigh stations and bus routes. Next year's Pride Build will look different in terms of turnout, Imbri says. While past builds have primarily worked with internal staff members or groups with shared values, next year the organization plans to go much bigger and open volunteer opportunities up to the public. And even though the houses aren't yet completed, the sense of unity and pride amongst the volunteers was felt all day, says Imbri. By August, the Hallidays will finally have a home of their own. Embry said, it was a good reminder of just how much bigger a house is than a house. It's a home, a place of stability, a safe place. It's a future. And now, from June the 1st, Jasmine Gallup column again from the Raleigh area, which I did not get to read yet. Families traumatized in an RPD raid settle with the city for $350,000. Raleigh lawyers have settled yet another civil suit related to former police officer Omar Abdullah's misconduct and string of wrongful arrests. In this case, Abdullah executed a search warrant on the wrong house based on a fabricated drug buy, leaving two black families traumatized from a SWAT-style raid on their homes, according to a news release from the nonprofit Emancipate NC. The raid was executed in a no-knock style, with police surrounding Yolanda Irving, Kenya Walton, and their respective children with automatic weapons, holding them in their homes for hours and ransacking rooms in search of drugs or money that wasn't there. In an agreement reached last week, the families will receive $350,000 from the city of Raleigh. That comes after more than a year of litigation and 3 years after the raid itself. Irving said in the news release, it's been a very long and stressful journey. We are still dealing with the trauma caused by this horrible situation, but after a long 3 years, justice was finally served. During the 16 months the case was fought in civil court, lawyers representing Raleigh mounted strong resistance. They prevented body camera footage of the raid from being publicly released, tried to get Emancipate NC removed from the case, and shielded Police Chief Estella Patterson from a deposition to answer questions about the department's policy on no-knock warrants. Irving, Walton, and their children were also subject to intense depositions where they were asked racially charged questions, such as, are you in touch with your birth father at all? When was the last time you had a job, if ever? And do you have a particular rap artist you like? Emancipate NC ultimately prevailed, however, successfully negotiating a settlement and, critically, putting an end to the use of no-knock warrants in Raleigh. 3 months after the lawsuit was filed, RPD adopted an official policy banning the use of no-knock warrants. And the news release from Emancipate also states, it prompted the RPD to create and enforce more stringent protections concerning the use of confidential informants in drug operations. Substantial changes have also been made to, quote, the staffing and operation of the Drugs and Vice Unit, to which Abdullah and the other defendant officers belonged. So far, 28 people have received settlements in cases centered around the misconduct of Abdullah and others with the Drugs and Vice Unit, says Abraham Rupert Sheol, one of the attorneys fighting on their behalf with law firm Tin, Fulton, Walker & Owen. The city paid out $2 million in 2021 and will soon pay an additional $350,000 for this most recent settlement. Additionally, a third case is pending. Ian Mance, senior counsel at Emancipate NC, says in the news release, the Raleigh informant scandal disrupted the lives of many innocent people and caused unnecessary trauma to our clients and others who were subjected to frightening police raids and arrests through no fault of their own. This could not have occurred if not for the indifference of multiple police officers to the civil rights of those they are sworn to protect. Hopefully, Raleigh office officials have learned their lesson. Policy changes are a step in the right direction, but only if they are enforced. Transparency remains essential. And another Jasmine Gallup column written on June 13th. Activists plead for divestment from police, but Raleigh bolsters spending on law enforcement once again. The city council will spend $130 million on its police force, and some taxpayers are asking why their money isn't instead going to low-income housing, public transportation, or social services. The question is one that's at the heart of budget debates in cities across America. In 2020, after the murder of George Floyd, calls to defund the police rang out nationally. Activists argue that money given to police officers who today respond to social crises, including poverty, substance use, and homelessness, should be reallocated to community services. Last week at Raleigh's public hearing on the budget for fiscal 2024, local activists continued their years-long campaign to get the city to divest from police and invest in other departments, which they say will ultimately make the community safer. Angaza Laughing House, an activist with the nonprofit Refund Raleigh, said in a relentless, rhythmic 3-minute speech, "There are countless studies talking about how to prevent crime. They talk about how jobs and living wages, how education and housing all serve to prevent crime in urban areas. I want to believe you're trying to do your best, but when I look at this city budget and I see over the past 3 years you've increased the housing and neighborhoods budget by just $2 million, but the police budget has gone up $21 million, it makes me question whether you're really trying or just talking." The pleas had no impact on the city council, which approved the proposed budget unanimously Monday with only a few minor changes. City officials defended their decision, saying the money spent on affordable housing and homelessness is more than is reflected in the budget. City Manager Marshall Adams Davis, quote, "Affordable housing is our number one council priority. The budget lifts up $33 million to address that." That money, he quoted, includes federal money, local money earmarked for housing, the city's penny tax for housing, and partnerships with our nonprofit builders and developers. But with each type of funding, federal, local, and private, there are still major gaps between how much is allocated to the police and how much to housing. At a local level, the city's individual departments, the Raleigh Police Department, is slated to receive about $131 million. That's a roughly $19 million increase over the 2020 budget. Meanwhile, the Housing and Neighborhoods Department, which is tasked with increasing the supply of affordable housing, is set to receive about $7 million, an increase of about 1.3 over fiscal 2021. "The additional expenditure on RPD won't expand the police force," explained Raleigh Budget Director Sadia Sattar. "Indeed, it will go mainly toward a 5% pay raise for police officers, as well as to purchasing laptops for recruits in the academy. The money will also cover increasing rental costs for some police buildings." Matthew Cooper, president of the Raleigh Police Protective Association, said, "The 5% pay raise is a good step forward, but RPD is still dealing with severe staffing shortages. In October of last year, RPD had 150 vacancies. Cooper, along with other advocates for officers and firefighters, has continually lobbied for higher pay for public safety workers. On the housing and neighborhood side, the money will help fund new employee training and the increasing costs of managing the housing bond that voters passed in 2020. Sattar says, in addition, the city is investing nearly $25 million in affordable housing this year from its capital fund, a pot of money that's usually used for long-term projects like the construction of new buildings. In this case, the money will fund the city's ongoing affordable housing programs, including down payment assistance, preserving existing affordable rental housing, and home repairs and rehabilitation. Sattar says, "I don't want people to think we didn't hear them, because we did." Activists from Refund Raleigh remain unsatisfied. Despite investments from the city, the amount of money dedicated to affordable housing remains small in comparison to the amount of money dedicated to public safety. Overall, funding for public safety, including money for police, fire, and emergency communications, as well as the construction of new police and fire stations, make up about 25% of this year's total budget of $1.26 billion. Dollars for housing, on the other hand, including the Housing and Neighborhoods Department and the city's affordable housing initiatives, make up only 3.5% of the total budget. Laughing House said, just think about if you had invested $21 million in affordable housing, where would we be right now after 3 years? If you invested $21 million into mental health, where would we be right now? The imbalance continues every single year. You cautiously sprinkle money into programs for the people, but you'll dump money into the police budget. Raleigh residents seem to agree that affordable housing and transport should be top budget priorities for council members. In an online survey the city conducted, residents also ranked providing affordable housing, reducing traffic accidents, and providing a connected, safe, and reliable bus and transit system as budget priorities. Respondents said they were highly important, but were dissatisfied with the existing services by the city. Nearly all respondents said that responding to community needs, fire, police, 9/11, was either extremely or somewhat important, but they were also mostly satisfied with the city's existing services. About 3,100 people responded to that survey. That's a 275% increase over the number of participants last year. Still, the survey results are only a small snapshot of how Raleigh's nearly 500,000 residents feel. Despite pressure from the community over the past few years, Raleigh council members have yet to hold a serious discussion about divesting from policing. When asked about residents' concerns that RPD does not keep people safe, Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin stood firm in her assessment that an investment in the police force is an investment in public safety. Quote, we have to invest in public safety. It's the number one concern. So we want to make sure our police officers are fairly compensated and shown appreciation and respect. At this time, we can't take money away from our police department. When you look at the market, our officers are paid less. So we're trying to increase their salary and invest more in our department. Across the country, major fund shifts from local police budgets to community services are still rare. A few cities, like Seattle, have taken steps to divest from policing, but the approach is cautious. In 2021, the city took $12 million from the police, an 18% cut, and $18 million from a community initiative fund, a total of $30 million, and let the people decide how to spend it. The participatory budget process is ongoing, so the results are not yet known. In another example, the Los Angeles School Board cut $25 million from its school police budget to help fund a $36.5 million initiative dubbed Black Student Achievement Plan. The plan included hiring additional social workers and counselors to fight high suspension rates, chronic absenteeism, and low academic achievement. A 2022 report showed that the initiative had not increased graduation rates, but it had increased literacy levels and the number of students earning better grades. Likewise, it hasn't decreased chronic absenteeism, but had increased access to mental health resources and decreased out-of-school suspension rates. This year, activists in Raleigh persisted with their demands the city make major reform to its ACORNS unit. That's a team of social workers and police officers that respond to mental health crises and connect residents with public services. Activists argue the unit should be independent of the police force. Last week, many cited Durham's HEART program created in 2022 as an example of what Raleigh should do. HEART is composed solely of social workers and mental health clinicians who respond to nonviolent behavioral health calls for service and follow up with people to connect them to resources or programs. Recently, Durham also created a co-response section where clinicians respond to higher risk calls alongside police officers. Activist Ajamu Dillahunt said at the hearing last week, I come to the meeting today frustrated because we are behind. The Durham City Council is not just talking about the success of the HEART program, they're expanding it. What are we doing? Baldwin says the council is considering changes to Acorns. Recently, council members met with the creator of Denver's STAR program, a unit activists say is a good model to examine how it worked. The independently funded program started out as a 5-year pilot, according to Baldwin. Quote, it's a very different model with a different funding stream. The city manager is looking how we can incorporate something that is uniquely Raleigh and serves our needs. Residents at last week's meeting were also frustrated with what they consider only small or moderate investments in affordable housing. Jackie Ayala, the director of advocacy for Habitat for Humanity of Wake County, said the organization is pleased the city continues to earmark local funding for affordable housing, but this year's budget, quote, doesn't go far enough to meet the need in our community. Additional local funding is critically needed to develop more subsidized affordable housing and create more home affordability options for residents. And Ayala added that cost of housing will continue to rise in 2024 as Duke Energy rates increase, property taxes increase, and construction costs remain high. Baldwin says the city will consider options to increase affordable housing funding in the next few years. As the $80 million housing bond runs out, those funds are expected to be spent by 2025, the city will look at putting another bond before voters and how much it should cost. Another option could be to dedicate 2 cents of the property tax to affordable housing, as Durham does, an increase from the 1 cent Raleigh currently dedicates. On Monday, Councilmember Jane Harrison said she supports doubling the roughly $7.8 million raised annually through that tax in 2025. And Baldwin said, we were very intentional not to raise property taxes except for the voter-approved tax, which was for the parks bond. We've got Wake County raising their tax rate, and we wanted to make sure there was a balance. Fair housing advocate Octavia Rainey, a frequent public commenter, raised an additional concern. Existing funds for affordable housing should go to help the people most in need, she said, specifically those making 30% or less of the annual median income, AMI, which is $113,000 currently for a family of four, according from data for the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. A family of four making 30% of the AMI would only earn about $34,000 per year. Many of the affordable housing projects Raleigh funds are open to people making 60 to 80% of the AMI. There's certainly a need for this kind of housing, but activists argue the city should prioritize housing for its poorest residents, including people experiencing homelessness. Leon Cook, a Raleigh resident who spoke during the hearing. You say you are for affordable housing. How do you define affordable? We should be talking about 30 or 40% below AMI. Developers may throw in a few units as 60% and feel good about it. We don't. Well, these very long articles have kind of contributed to me running short of time. for the rest of Indie Week. Several articles. I won't be able to get to it all. I'll just list them, and you can find them at IndieWeek.com should you be interested. One talks about Orange County mental health crisis and criminal justice reform. Hannah Kaufman wrote that back on June the 2nd. And then there is another longish article about the new American Dance Festival season, which is starting up very soon. And, in fact, it's the day before the 2023 season opens, and the numbers are looking good at the ADF. Ticket sales are up 80%, and there are many, many famous recipients of grants and awards and seasons that have been here many times before, like Palabolas, Paul Taylor, Bill T. Jones, Rennie Harris. Still, one-third of the companies and choreographers on ADF main stages will mark their first appearance at this year's festival. And the article goes on with quotes and other things, photographs, pictures of some of the artists, where it is looking very positive this year. And that's a mainstay of summer culture and entertainment in and around Durham mostly, but many people come from wide areas around North Carolina to see American Dance Festival. We're glad to see them back. Well, coverage of these long articles and detailed articles, even if when I excerpt to them, has filled up our 58 minutes today. I know there's the Indie Week contains a lot more, including their weekly calendar of arts and culture events around the whole Triangle area. And I hope that I will be able more selective in picking out at least a few of those to read for the listeners as we go on in time. I have to judge how much weight to put on the news and public affairs and how much on the culture, which I find important anyway. At any rate, John Federson is now going to bid a reluctant farewell, reluctant except my vocal cords are breaking down. So Indie Week will return and is available as a podcast at ncreadingservice.org if you wish to hear us and any other previous issues from this worthwhile publication. So John Federson saying so long for Indie Week.